The country will make a collective groan today with the news that reopening could be delayed by 2 to 3 weeks because of vaccine supply problems. So says the Irish Daily Mirror in an editorial. There is a more cheerful approach taken by the Irish Daily Mail. The paper reports that greater freedoms for fully vaccinated older people who have, according to the chief medical officer, shouldered a heavy burden since the start of the pandemic, are expected to be announced next week. Cabinet sources said last night that such a vaccine bonus would broadly follow the guidance in the United States, where fully inoculated people are allowed to gather indoors without masks or physical distancing. The Irish Times leads with news that serious blood clotting events in people who received the AstraZeneca vaccine have been reported by the state's medicines regulator for the first time. The Health Protection Regulatory Authority says it has received a small number, under 5, reports of blood clotting type events combined with low platelets in people who received the vaccine. The Irish Examiner reports that just 3 women have lodged claims to the Cervical Check Tribunal, despite more than €2.5 million being spent to set up and run the body. The paper quotes opposition TDs as saying that affected women and their families do not have faith in the tribunal and are choosing to go to court instead. The admission by Mary Lou MacDonald, the leader of Sinn Féin, that her party's secret database of voters, known as ABU, was not in compliance with data protection laws, gives the Irish Independent its lead story. Philip Ryan writes that speaking last night on RTE's primetime, she said that Sinn Féin had appointed a data protection officer to oversee the personal information of millions of voters only after being contacted by the Data Protection Commissioner about its ABU database. It was in an interview with Jonathan Healy on News Talk yesterday that Mary Lou MacDonald finally spilled the beans on where they are keeping all your personal information, writes Ryan. First the UK, then Germany. But he says there are many other questions, such as who developed the database or how it was paid for. The Irish Sun reports that the mixed martial arts fighter Conor McGregor has bought the pub where 2 years ago he assaulted a customer who refused to drink a shot of his brand of whiskey. The Irish Daily Star leads with the seizure yesterday by the Criminal Assets Bureau of what it calls the flashy mansion of Liverpool soccer fanatic Patrick Coffey in County Kerry. Cab nab fans pad, says the headline.
A 14-year-old girl who went missing from her County Louth home on Monday has been found safe and well. Gardaí say she was found in the Belfast area and that their child rescue alert has now been stood down. Our North East correspondent Sinead Hussey is on the line. Sinead, what more can you tell us?
Yeah, Rachel, the Child Rescue Ireland alert was stood down at around 20 past 10 last night, Gardaí confirming in a statement that the 14-year-old girl had been located safe and well in the Belfast area. They said that she was with the PSNI and was about to be reunited with her family. In that statement, Gardaí also confirmed that an 18-year-old man had been arrested by the Police Service of Northern Ireland and he remains in police custody this morning. This was a significant cross-border operation yesterday involving the Gardaí and the PSNI. All day long, Gardaí making appeals for information on the 14-year-old's whereabouts. They had established that she'd left her home in County Louth on Monday. She'd crossed the border and was seen in Newry in County Down on Monday evening. The car she was travelling in had also been seen in Belfast on Wednesday evening. Last night, Gardaí said they were not providing any further information on this case, but they thanked the public and other agencies for their help that they provided during the alert, which lasted almost 24 hours.
It's worth saying, Sinead, that child rescue alerts are very rare.
They're very rare and they're only issued in the most urgent cases where Gardaí believe that there is a serious risk to a child and strict criteria has to be met before any decision is made to issue a cry alert. And this was a case that Gardaí had been following since Monday evening and they took the decision late on Wednesday night, early into Thursday morning to issue this cry alert. And it is just the 8th cry alert issued since the system was first introduced 9 years ago in May 2012.
Sinead, thanks indeed for that. Sinead Hussey there, our North East correspondent.
Hairdressers, driving lessons and many outdoor activities are reopening in Northern Ireland as they begin to ease restrictions after 3 months of lockdown. More than a million people in the north have had their first vaccine, but three more COVID-related deaths were reported on Thursday and another 120 new cases. Dr. Gerry Waldron is the head of health protection at Northern Ireland's. Excuse me, Dr. Waldron, Public Health Agency. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
Give us the COVID picture in Northern Ireland as you reopen some close contact services and outdoor activities today.
Well, as you mentioned, Anya, we're still seeing numbers of cases and tragically we're still getting deaths. But those numbers are much, much lower than they were when we started into lockdown and even in the middle of January when we were seeing the peak of this particular wave. So things are moving in the right direction. It's a positive picture and we're taking tentative steps to move a little bit closer towards normality, but they are very tentative. And the messages that we're giving to people is that despite the easing of the restrictions, we are asking people to still be very, very careful because the virus is still out there. The virus is highly transmissible and it wouldn't take very much for us to get back into a bad place again. So care and attention as we ease ourselves out of lockdown.
The vaccination rollout in Northern Ireland, where's it at?
Well, as you've mentioned again, Anya, we've over a million people vaccinated, and a large number of those have actually received their second doses, particularly in the very vulnerable people, the over 80s, the over 70s. We've had a very good uptake in those age groups, kind of going into the high 90%. So we're in a very, very good place. We have a large proportion of the most vulnerable people have been vaccinated and are protected. But at the same time, vulnerable people are very healthy people, if they get COVID, can have tragic consequences. It's more unusual, but it still can happen. So that's why we keep urging people to be careful, keep themselves safe, and keep their community and their loved ones safe.
What's your take on the concerns over rare blood clots and the Astra and Johnson vaccines? Hello, Dr. Gerry Waldron. We appear to have lost the connection with Dr. Gerry Waldron there. That's Dr. Gerry Waldron, the head of health protection at Northern Ireland's Public Health Agency. And we'll be hearing more later in the programme from our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney, who I believe will be in a barber's or a hairdresser's, which is where we'd all love to be this morning.
The number of new COVID cases in the south increased to 617 yesterday, with schools and workplaces responsible for a significant part of that rise. 10 deaths were reported, 7 of them occurred over the past month. Now, some counties have a disproportionate number of new infections. Apart from Dublin, there were substantial rises in Donegal, Offaly, Kildare and Meath. According to the latest figures also, 176 people are in hospital, 48 of them are in intensive care. The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, returned to the NPHET briefing last night. He said he was hopeful that the country was moving to a point where restrictions could be eased.
Since early February, and I was last with you, the disease has really changed in terms of the transmission patterns that we can see, and we also can see a substantial portion of the population, very small numbers who were vaccinated back then, a substantial portion of the population, particularly those at risk, being vaccinated. So that's a changed and changing situation. When I look at those two things and coming back to work, it gives me real hope and confidence that we're moving through our response to this disease in a way that might enable us to be ambitious about the kinds of things that are sensible for us to contemplate in easing or potentially advising in relation to the easing of restrictions.
Professor Philip Nolan said that while there had been a small spike in cases, the outlook was broadly positive.
We do see a significant effect of vaccination, but of course, obviously, only in those who have been vaccinated, and it's important not to see an effect where it doesn't yet exist. So this is a broadly positive outlook. But we do remain very vulnerable, particularly in the coming weeks, because the wider population is not yet protected by vaccination. They will be, and it will be soon, but between now and then, the situation does remain volatile and vulnerable, and any increase in close contact or mixing does represent a very high risk.
And that was Professor Philip Nolan. For more now, we can talk to our science correspondent, George Lee. Morning, George.
Good morning, Rachel.
Let's talk about where these cases are occurring. It seems that there are some significant workplace clusters, including the one we learnt about yesterday at Intel in County Kildare.
Yes, well, they said that in terms of workplace clusters over the past week, there's been 12, is what they pointed out. That was a little bit down, maybe by one or two on the previous week. It certainly wasn't outstanding in terms of its change on the previous week, but that they were spread around the country. And I suppose Intel is the one that's classic that people will see in the headlines right now, which is in the construction industry in the main, because a lot of them were construction workers. The point is that they were making is that it's about 10 days in terms of what this report was, because these are the cases from the day before as such. Since people went back to school full-time, since they went back to work in the construction sector and so on. And that is a period during which you get the infections beginning to spread, and it would take up to 10 days for those infections to be recorded and for symptoms to get to such a level that you can record them. So in one sense, it's not surprising that it is right now that you have this little spike in cases. What is interesting is that they think it's transient. That means they don't think it's going to last, because they believe that people, when they see the numbers going up like that, tend to pull in their horns, for want of a better description, and say, here, hang on, the public takes on board a spike in cases and behaves accordingly in terms of trying to bring it down. So they're very hopeful that that will happen again. One of the things which has been very striking, particularly in the numbers in the last 10 days, has been an increase in incidents among people, young people in the age group of 13 to 18, secondary school students. And they also have just gone back for the first time for most of those classes, really since Christmas. And so because of that, there's been this huge increase in vigilance, lots of attention in relation to what's going on in the schools, lots of references, huge increase in referrals for testing in that age group, and they're finding more. And they feel that they've seen this before when primary schools went back and it settled down, because a lot of it was to do with a huge focus on that area, and so you find more if you look for more. And they think that something like that could happen in the secondary schools. But the key issue, I think, is what Philip Nolan suggested in the clip that you ran there, is that right now they're dependent on people really sticking with the programme, that they don't move ahead. The optimism and the positivity expressed there by the chief medical officer, that we're heading towards a situation where you can be confident of an easing of restrictions, that's great. But they're really worried about what they call anticipatory behaviour that they've seen before, which is where the public says, oh, we're there, and the public then begins to relax and does it too soon. And if they do that, we blow it. So it's about, I think the message they were saying is, we're going in the right direction. Don't get carried away. Keep doing what you're doing at the moment, and we're going to get to a situation where we can relax these restrictions. And, you know, in the workplaces, it's there. In schools, it's there. But they're hoping that it's more transient than it appears.
Of course, an awful lot depends on the vaccine rollout. And the HSE also had a briefing yesterday afternoon. And I think a very large part of that was focused on vaccinations. What did we learn?
Well, we learned that they're quite frustrated, actually, about the difficulty they have in terms of planning right now, that they would have hoped to have about 200,000 vaccine doses that they could administer in the coming week. They'll do about 150,000, but they're short next week because, number one, AstraZeneca hasn't come through with deliveries that they thought they would come through with, 45,000 doses. That is turning out to be 9,000, and that even ahead of that, for the end of the month, another of the order of 135,000 doses. They're not sure when they're going to get them, but it's going to be sometime in early May rather than late April, and that's really difficult for planning. The second thing we learned is that they're very concerned about what the impact will be of the decision from NIAC about whether or not we can or cannot use the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. That's the decision we're waiting for. There's 600,000 of those due before the end of June, and they already have about 15,000 in cold storage. They need to use them if they're going to achieve the government's target of having about 80% of adults vaccinated by the end of June. And so they're waiting on that. So they don't know where they stand with regard to how they can plan at the moment. And it's clearly is frustrating to them. What Paul Reid, the chief executive, said was that if they cannot use the Johnson & Johnson vaccines, it will have a significant impact on the rollout in terms of what they can achieve, certainly in the coming months. So they're worried about whether or not they might be left with lots and lots of vaccines that they can't use.
One other final vaccine-related question, George. Confirmation this morning from the medicines regulator here that it has received reports of blood clots in people who received the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Yes. So the AstraZeneca vaccine is the vaccine which has been at the centre of the investigation, the previous investigation by the European Medicines Agency, where they said that as far as they're concerned now, they can see a link, but they don't fully understand how it's caused, between these very rare blood clots, which are low platelet blood clots in blood vessels drawing blood from the veins, from the brain, and that's a very unusual type of blood clot. And they said it's very rare, but they found it in Europe. And now what we're finding here is that there have been 29 cases of various blood clots associated with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and less than 5 of them are the rare kind. And they haven't reported any fatalities yet, but it is interesting that they're saying, yes, we have found this small rare side effect here. Now, in terms of blood clotting, a lot of the blood clotting events are more normal, very similar to what you get in a normal population. So they're not saying that most of these blood clots are related to this very rare event. And it also, they have found that there have been blood clotting events associated with the mRNA vaccines too. 41 is what they say in relation to that, but that, again, none of the rare kinds have been associated with that. They're more related to stuff going on in the population. So it is interesting like that we're seeing that very rare link, which has been well established or well spoken about now in relation to the AstraZeneca. And it puts back the pressure and the question about what happens now about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It is the same type of vaccine. There has been the same link to these very rare blood clots in the United States, where that vaccine has been in use for some time. They are the same type of proportions. Mm. They are the same kind of situations where it tends to be majority female, majority under the age of 50. Very rare, but somehow unusual, and that's why they're spotting them. Right. And then the NIAC people have to decide, what are they going to do? Will they allow the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, knowing that there is this link here? So it's all in play at the moment.
It is indeed an important few days ahead. George, thank you very much.
Now let's hear about some of the preparations that are being made for reopening here next week. Amy Ní Riadh reports.
We'll go for a look at the baby lambs first. Only born yesterday, so they'll be getting ready to be getting used to people. They're enjoying the peace and quiet that will shortly be shattered, hopefully.
Jerry Kennedy is doing some last-minute jobs on his family's pet farm ahead of next week's reopening.
The geese over here inside in the ponds, the peacocks are straight down here.
Kennedy's pet farm is on the Cork Road, just outside Killarney, and in a normal year, usually attracts over 25,000 visitors.
It is nice to have the place to ourselves a small bit during the summer when the weather is good, like, you know. The Easter weekend would usually be one of our busiest weekends of the year. And just after missing out on it the last 2 years, like, you know, the sun happened to be splitting the stones both of the Easter Sundays, like, so you'd be saying to yourself, geez, we should be rushed off our feet now. But the other side to that then is you get a bit of a chance to recharge your batteries. The piggies inside there then. Nickel and Rasher. Or sausage and Rasher, I mean, sorry.
The pet farm has been used as a playground by Jerry's two children, but they won't have it all to themselves for much longer.
Their farm, so once we open, they're going to have to get used to it not being just their playground again for a while, you know.
It's a costly vocation, caring for animals, but one thing that is almost certain to boost revenue is school tours, even if the school comes with its very own tour guide.
They've started booking a lot more local now than any other year. The only downside to that is my daughter is getting her school tour to get into this pet farm, so I don't know if she'd be too happy with the whole thing like it.
Across the border in Cork is another popular outdoor attraction in Fota Wildlife Park. However, they'll be relying on more than school buses in order to survive another winter. Fota says they need the restrictions to remain lifted until at least September. Sean McKeown is the director.
The income that we get in the next month or two, it really keeps us going towards the end of summer. But it's really July and August and hopefully September, you know, if we're open fully without many restrictions, that will give us the money to survive the winter. Sometimes in the busy periods, you feel like, God, it wouldn't be great to have a day when there's peace and quiet around the place. and no visitors. And then after 4 months, you just can't wait to have them back.
Last winter was a particularly long one for anyone in the tourism industry, with thousands of people either being laid off or simply walking away from the uncertainty around the sector. Vanessa McTighe is the head of commercial operations for Shannon Heritage, which will also be opening sites around the country.
Bunratty Folk Park, Malahide Gardens and Newbridge House are going to reopen. We're delighted that we're just commencing to reopen our sites next week. The team are very excited to get reopened again. It's been a particularly difficult time since Christmas. All of our staff have been on layoff since December, with the exception of some of our core maintenance team looking after and caring for our animals and our heritage sites.
So, signs of hope for all those people looking forward to Monday. Vanessa McTighe there, ending that report by Amy Nereada.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Morning Ireland, 24 minutes to 8, and here's Des with the sports news.
Yeah, good morning, Anya. The news of Irish gymnastics continues to cheer us up. A further boost yesterday, Rhys McClenaghan and Adam Steele joined Emma Slevin in qualifying for finals at the European Gymnastics Championships in Switzerland. McClenaghan secured his place in the pommel horse final, qualifying in first position with a score of 14.766. That final takes place tomorrow afternoon. Adam Steele also had an excellent competition. He competed on all six of the men's apparatus and finished in 20th place with a score of 79.731. But in doing so, he's made it to the men's all-round final, which takes place this afternoon. It'll be live on the RTE player. And this follows on from the women's all-round top 24 final, which of course has Emma Slevin featuring. That's live on RTE2 from 12:15 p.m. Now, there's one game in the English Premier League last night where Leicester City beat West Brom by 3-0. Jamie Vardy, Johnny Evans and Kelechi Iheanacho got the goals in a blistering first half. So while West Brom are staring relegation in the face, Leicester remain in third place and look good for a Champions League spot. They're 4 points clear of both Chelsea and West Ham. Here's the Leicester captain, Johnny Evans.
It was a good sort of first half performance in terms of goals. You know, we were probably disappointed the way we passed the ball at times, but you know, we got the 3-0 and we were determined to keep a clean sheet, really, to get through the game. You know, when you go 3-0 up at half time, you know it's going to be difficult for, you know, for West Brom to come back into it. They changed the shape a bit in the second half to kind of match what we were doing, and you know, it made it a bit more difficult for us to break them down. And I think really the last 10 minutes, I think, you know, both teams were wanting to match the end, really.
In terms of the race for the top four, you're now 4 points clear of Chelsea and West Ham, who are your sort of direct challengers. I suppose, given what happened last season, how you missed out, how much does that sort of, you know, give you that impetus this season to just not make the same mistake again?
I think what we learned from last year is, you know, how easy points gap can, you know, quickly be eaten at. And I think we went away for the delayed winter break last year, and we came back and got off to a bad start, really, and it cost us in the end.
That's Johnny Evans. Back home, we have two games in the Premier Division tonight. Finn Harps play St Pat's at 5:45, and then Shamrock Rovers take on Bohemians at 7:45 in the live RTE game. St Pat's Lee Desmond has been talking to Adrian Eames about the challenge they'll face in Donegal.
I think it's a different type of test than anything we've had so far this season. They'll give us a different type of challenge because they're so physical. They're very tall, so the idea that like Finn Harps is a handy game, like, is long gone now. They're right up there themselves.
And have they improved on last year?
They definitely have. I know they haven't made much changes personnel wise, but they've improved overall as a team. And over the last couple of years, they've added more quality up the higher end of the pitch with McNamee and Foley, and then you've got the big boys at the back who are doing a very good job and very tough to break down. So, as I said, a different type of challenge for us, but our confidence is very high now.
That's live on Watch LOI this evening. There are four games in the First Division and one in England, where Arsenal meet Everton. Meanwhile, Waterford issued a statement last night to confirm that Kevin Sheedy and Mike Newell remain in charge after speculation yesterday they had left the club. Derry City are expected to name their new manager this morning after parting with Declan Devine. The strong speculation that Rory Higgins is to be offered the job. Higgins is currently part of Stephen Kenny's backroom team with the Irish national squad, where he's chief scout and opposition analyst. In golf, Leona Maguire and Stephanie Meadow both failed to make the cut at the LA Open. Maguire shot 76 to finish on 3 over, one shot outside the cut. Meadow was 7 over. Jessica Korda leads on 13 under. And Graham McDowell and Matt Wallace shot an opening 6 under par 66 at the Zurich Classic. It's an unusual pairs event. The leaders are on 10 under. In rugby, Ulster take on Connacht tonight in the first of the Rainbow Cup matches. We'll be looking ahead to that and the women's Six Nations game later in the programme. In swimming, Danny Hill and Finn McGeever enjoyed fine evening at the Irish National Swimming Team Trials. Danielle Hill broke her third record of the meet, the 100 metres freestyle record, in 55.33 seconds. And Finn McGeever broke the Irish senior record in the 400 freestyle, clocking 3 minutes, 52.83 seconds. The Irish senior men's and women's basketball teams return to training today after COVID as they prepare for the European Championships. And we have two race meetings at Cork and Kilbeggan.
A rescue operation is racing against time to try to recover the 53 crew of an Indonesian submarine. The vessel went missing on Wednesday morning and only has enough oxygen to last 3 days. Anne Barker is the Indonesia correspondent for ABC News. Anne, what do we know about what happened here?
Anya, we know that the submarine was carrying out a training exercise on Wednesday morning, a torpedo drill, and it was literally as they were due to file some results from that drill that they lost contact with the naval authorities at the nearby base. That was in the early hours of the morning. And almost immediately there was a search that began in the waters about 60 nautical miles north of Bali. Now, since then, we've heard that there are more than 20 ships, most of them Indonesian, as well as other smaller craft that are scouring the sea in the area north of Bali. There are ships coming from Malaysia, from Australia, from India and so on. But look, it's a desperate search now because, as you say, there is only limited oxygen on board. In fact, if the submarine can't surface to get its own supply of air, it's likely to run out by 3 a.m. tomorrow morning, Saturday morning. So there's well under 24 hours left now that the 53 crew on board could survive if they're not rescued somehow by the many ships in the area.
And are there concerns that the submarine may have fallen into a part of the ocean that's too deep for rescue?
That is what military authorities have speculated on. The seas north of Bali are actually very deep. There are areas where it goes to at least 1,500 metres. One military authority yesterday said that he fears that it could have gone down as low as 600 to 700 metres. Now, that's well beyond the capacity of this submarine. It's the military authorities are saying that it's got a capacity to sort of stay safely submerged between 250 to 500 metres. Once it goes below that depth, then it's more or less almost certain to implode. The pressure at that depth of ocean will just collapse the hull, crush the hull, and that's what we've seen in previous accidents. There was one in Argentina a few years ago where a similar thing happened, and they later established that that was how many people died on board. They did say yesterday that there's some sort of mystery object that's been detected in much shallower waters, about 50 to 100 metres deep, that they say has a very high magnetic force. Now, they haven't got the equipment yet to actually find that and establish what it is. They're hoping, of course, that it is the submarine, and if it's in that sort of shallow depth, then it would be retrievable, it would be rescuable. But they're waiting for a particular sonar ship to come from Java. I think it was due to arrive possibly today or maybe overnight. But as I say, the time here is absolutely critical because, as you know, we have so little time left to rescue the submarine and take anyone on board out before the oxygen supply will completely run out.
Anne Barker, Indonesia correspondent for ABC News, thank you for filling us in on that.
Last week, the government's eviction ban, which was linked to the 5 kilometre travel restriction rule, came to an end. And this morning, a 10-day grace period also closes, meaning evictions not linked to an inability to pay rent because of the pandemic can take place. Fikra Okyanu reports.
So coming home for one of the last few times now, you come in and you see all the things that you took for granted when you were in a house with stability. You see the TV, the kitchen utensils, the kids' toys, and you know you can't fit them in to the boot of your car.
Today is a difficult day for John.
The COVID-19 eviction ban ends today after a 10-day grace period. And for John, who is using an alias to protect his identity, it means a year after his landlord told him he is selling the property, he now fears he will become homeless.
It was January 2020. My landlord said he wants to sell the property. Due to COVID, we've had a certain amount of reprieve, but because of all the fears about it, the rental market around this area has crashed altogether.
We'd all accept that we're far from over the COVID crisis. I don't think there's a day that goes by when we don't hear the Minister for Health or another minister telling us.
Aideen Hayden is chair of housing charity Threshold. While she accepts the government has extended specific protections until July for people who have lost income due to COVID, Aideen says now is still the wrong time to end the eviction ban for people like John.
Ending the eviction ban is incredibly disappointing and very premature. It will put a lot of people at immediate risk of losing their homes. We are looking at, in Threshold alone, 1,000 cases that we have over from 2020, and not including the cases that we're now dealing with in 2021. We would like to see an extension of at least 6 months, because we believe it's going to take a minimum of 6 months for any kind of normality to come back.
It's not the full story, of course. Landlords are also affected.
It's essential that the market be allowed to return to some normality. We have landlords in financial distress because existing tenants' notices has been paused.
Margaret McCormack is spokesperson for the Irish Property Owners Association.
People with children that may need to move back into homes haven't been able to do so. We also have tenants who were in rent arrears prior to COVID being protected, and landlords at their wits' end under huge financial strain.
Okay, let me show you around my home now, for the moment.
In a different part of Ireland, Tony Geraghty is facing the same problem as John. Tony currently lives in the St Helens Court complex in Dunleary in Dublin. The complex is owned by Donegal firm Mill Street Projects and has recently been the subject of a standoff over redevelopment plans. A mass eviction is planned for today, and while rare, it means Tony and his neighbours must move out immediately.
We don't really know what's going to happen on the Friday. There's two elderly people who are really sick. I personally had a stroke 3 years ago. A lot of people here, they're really worried, really scared. We go out that gate with our bags in this present moment. We're living on the streets.
Mill Street Projects did not respond to requests for comment from Morning Ireland. But Dunleary Rathdown County Council told this programme social housing supports are available. The competing views of tenants, landlords and more complex cases mean some believe ending the eviction ban now could replace one problem with another. Here's Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson and TD for Dublin Midwest, Owen O'Brien.
Well, the fear many of us have is over a number of months, you will see an incremental increase in the number of families with children presenting as homeless. Those people will be put at increased risk of contracting COVID-19 because they'll be out looking for properties. We want the general ban on evictions and rent increases to be extended until the end of the year. What I would say to landlords is work with your tenants. And what I'd say to government is work with landlords to get forbearance on their mortgages. There are better solutions than simply lifting the blanket ban on evictions.
Not so, says Minister for Housing and Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin Fingal, Dara O'Brien.
Effectively, since March 2020, there have been very strong additional rental protections. That's over a year now. Less than 2% of tenancies end up in any type of dispute. But in those ones where there's difficulties, and particularly difficulties that people have paying their rent because of COVID, they're going to be protected until the 12th of July. I've got to balance the rights of tenants with the rights of the property owners. And let's remember, nearly 9 out of 10 of every landlord are normal people who own one or two properties. I'm making sure there's no cliff edge here.
Officially, no cliff edge. But it doesn't make today any easier for John.
I'm at the point where I'm trying to pick out the most valuable things to us as a family and see if I can fit them in the boot of the car, because that's the only room I'm going to have. I have to look the girls in the eyes and tell them, and that's not going to be easy.
And that was John ending that report from Fiacra O'Kioni.
Plans are being unveiled this morning for the expansion of Galway Technology Centre. The office space in Galway City was established 25 years ago and so far has helped over 300 businesses to scale and grow. The expansion, which is significantly funded by Enterprise Ireland, is expected to help create thousands of jobs in the West over the coming years. Kenny Deary, one of the directors of the Galway Tech Centre and CEO of Galway Chamber, joins us on the line. Kenny, these expansion plans are being released today to mark 25 years of the centre, a significant milestone.
It certainly is. Good morning, Jill. For some context for your listeners, I suppose Galway Technology Centre was born out of a very different economic environment. One of the largest employers at the time in the 90s, Digital Equipment Corporation, closed their Galway facility, leading to hundreds of highly qualified people being laid off. In response, a special government task force was created at the time, chaired by the then Galway City and County Manager, but made up of Galway Chamber, Westvic and other stakeholders. And Jill, out of that, GTC, as we call it, was created as a subsidiary of Galway Chamber and Westvic. And here we are 25 years later with a state-of-the-art facility, 50,000 square foot, at present hosting some 41 companies in Galway. So it has been a great turnaround.
Kenny, tell us about the works that are being carried out now on the centre and when they're likely to be completed.
Yes, Jill, we're expanding up and out. So an additional 22,000 square foot is being added onto the existing facility, as you say, supported through the Enterprise Ireland Regional Enterprise Development Fund. For those unfamiliar with our site in Merview, that will create a fairly impressive visage. And also the space is being reconfigured to take stock of what working in a post-COVID world will look like. It's a very exciting project and something that my colleagues on the board under the chairmanship of Frank Green are looking forward to bringing to fruition. We expect delivery of the additional space to be complete by quarter 4/22, so at the end of next year. Obviously, like many projects, COVID has had its impact in adjusting our delivery timelines.
As well as the physical upgrade to the centre, the Academy West programme is being expanded to help support businesses. Tell us about that programme and the role it'll play.
Absolutely. So there are two parts to this investment. There's the physical building, which we've talked to, and then there is Academy West. This is something we're really excited by. We will see in the first step over the coming months recruitment of additional staff into GTC itself in enabling roles such as regional outreach and collaboration manager, client scaling manager, and a director of entrepreneurship and innovation. And I think the context for this is many companies start and get to the initial 5-10 employees and first rounds of investment. But at that stage, the leaders are so busy delivering and running the business that it can be difficult to look up and start raising the next rounds of investment, expanding and scaling with new products into new markets. What Academy West will do is work with those companies along with partners to help align them to funding pots and investors and help build that enabling network that's so important, not just in Galway, but on a regional basis. The whole point is to help companies grow, creating more sustainable jobs in the West region, supported by Enterprise Ireland.
And how many jobs do you expect will be created as a result of this expansion over the coming years, Kenny?
Yes, well, we have ambitious growth plans for the companies we'll be supporting and working with. We know what can be achieved from our past and have agreed with Enterprise Ireland growth targets that will see cumulative employment be mapped out on a 5, 10 and 15 year basis. The first benchmark will be an additional 820 odd jobs after the first 5 years, and on from there up to years 10 and 15, where the cumulative effect of this investment will see an additional 12,500 jobs enabled in the region. And this is not about companies remaining at a static level. It would operate like a funnel. We'll work with IDA companies investing in the region until they find their own footprint, and we will support scaling domestic companies until they do the same.
Okay, Kenny Deary, Director of the Galway Tech Centre and CEO of Galway Chamber, thanks for joining us.
Freedom for vaccinated, says the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mail. The paper reports that greater freedoms for fully vaccinated older people who have, according to the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, shouldered a heavy burden since the start of the pandemic, are expected to be announced next week. Cabinet sources said last night that such a vaccine bonus would broadly follow the guidance in the United States, where fully inoculated people are allowed to gather indoors without masks or physical distancing. But the country will make a collective groan today with the news that reopening could be delayed by 2 to 3 weeks because of vaccine supply problems, so says the Irish Daily Mirror in an editorial. And reopening is on a knife edge, says the Irish Independent, as the Chief Medical Officer warned of some numbers in recent days that give us reason for concern. The Irish Times leads with news that a small number of serious blood clotting events, under 5 of them, in people who received the AstraZeneca vaccine have been reported by the state's medicines regulator for the first time. The Irish Examiner reports that just three women have lodged claims to the Cervical Czech Tribunal, despite more than €2.5 million being spent to set up and run the body. The paper quotes opposition TDs as saying that affected women and their families do not have faith in the tribunal and are choosing to go to court instead. The admission by Mary Lou MacDonald, the leader of Sinn Féin, that her party's secret database of voters, known as ABU, was not in compliance with data protection laws, gives The Independent its lead story. Philip Ryan writes that speaking last night on RTE's primetime, she said that Sinn Féin had appointed a data protection officer to oversee the personal information of millions of voters only after being contacted by the Data Protection Commissioner about its ABU database. It was in an interview with Jonathan Healy on News Talk yesterday that Mary Lou MacDonald finally spilled the beans on where they are keeping all your personal information, writes Ryan. First the UK, then Germany. But he says there are many other questions, such as who developed the database or how it was paid for. The Irish News reports that DUP MPs advised the head of Mid and East Antrim Council to write to a British government department voicing concerns about the Northern Ireland Protocol, days before staff were withdrawn from Larne Port. The Irish Sun reports that the mixed martial arts fighter Conor McGregor has bought the pub, the Marble Arch in Drimna, Dublin, where 2 years ago he assaulted a customer who refused to drink a shot of his brand of whiskey. The Irish Daily Star leads with the seizure yesterday by the Criminal Assets Bureau of what the paper calls the flashy mansion of Liverpool soccer fanatic Patrick Coffey in County Kerry. Cab nab fans pad, says the headline. In The Times, Colm Keane writes that the new guidelines on personal injury awards, which were adopted by the Judicial Council in March after a vote among the state's judges, will come into effect from tomorrow. But according to a spokesman for the Law Society, there is not a hope that insurance premiums will start coming down quickly following the introduction of the guidelines.
Has Europe turned the corner in its vaccine rollout programme after a sluggish start? How do we compare to other member states when it comes to getting shots in the arms? The Irish Times Europe correspondent Naomi O'Leary has been looking at how the rollout is going across the EU. And overall, Naomi, is there a sense that a corner has been turned, or are there still problems with vaccine supplies?
Certainly the rollout has shifted into a new gear in a number of member states. You've seen the likes of Germany, France, Spain hitting new records and vaccinating hundreds of thousands of people a day each. So at this point, we're looking at rates across the European Union going up to comparable to what they were in the United States a little while ago, which is pretty fast. There are forecast to be, you know, supplies increasing further over the next couple of months, and at the moment we don't have information that that's going to change. So certainly it's it does seem to have turned a corner, as was predicted to happen at this point.
How do we compare?
Ireland is bang on the EU average, more or less. So different countries have made different choices in terms of their priority groups. Ireland's choices are, in line with many other countries. It depends on a number of factors. Databases is an issue. Local infection patterns. But the speed in Ireland is pretty much EU average at the moment. It would be, I suppose, an interesting case to compare with might be Denmark, because it's a similar size. Denmark has been a little bit quicker in terms of getting vaccines out. That has something to do with the kind of unified database system that their healthcare system has, and also the fact that they secured extra Pfizer vaccines when other countries turned them down earlier than Ireland did. Ireland got a few extra Moderna jabs, but it was Denmark was a little bit quicker to do that. But all in all, I mean, there aren't dramatic differences at this point between EU member states, except for a couple of outliers like Malta. Malta has only 500,000 citizens, so it's about half the size of Dublin, and they were able to get a meaningful amount extra of vaccines, so that they're significantly further ahead than others. And some countries chose to accept vaccines that aren't approved by the European Medicines Agency, like Hungary took Sputnik and Sinopharm vaccines, and that's helped them get ahead as well.
How are different countries dealing with the Astra and Johnson vaccines, and what restrictions are they applying to their use?
In general, there's a bit of an east-west split on that. So when it comes to AstraZeneca, a lot of the wealthier countries have chosen to, at least for now, limit it to older age groups. Whereas eastern countries that are depending more on the AstraZeneca jab, it is cheaper and easier to roll out, have chosen not to put in restrictions. So, that has to do with the availability of other vaccines, apart from anything else. If you do have the choice and you have enough supply of mRNA vaccines to go from, you could make that decision. It's a difficult issue for several member states. What the European Medicines Agency has said is that they don't recommend restricting it to any age groups. They think it's okay. They've given it the nod as safe and effective. But member states can make different decisions based on how prevalent infections are. So how much is a 30-year-old at risk of getting infected makes a difference in terms of whether you approve it for younger groups in terms of the risk-benefit analysis.
Is the EU taking legal action against AstraZeneca? There seemed to be some confusion on the topic yesterday.
What we had was a report that the European Commission had said to diplomats in a briefing on Wednesday that it was preparing to launch its legal action against AstraZeneca, which it had kind of indicated that it might do, although it always said that, its most immediate priority was to just get them to fulfil the contracts, because obviously the most urgent thing isn't sort of like judicial resolution of this issue, but actually getting vaccines to people. At this point, we can see, though, that overall the EU has shifted its vaccine strategy away from AstraZeneca and Johnson as well, in that they're deciding not to renew or take up like a new generation of those vaccines, but instead to double down on the mRNA vaccines. So they're preparing to sign an extremely large contract with Pfizer, which is, to get in the region of about 2 billion vaccines for over the next 2 years, which is aimed at the next generation of vaccines. So ones that are updated to cope with variants and with the anticipation that people may need booster shots.
Interesting stuff. Thank you for filling us in. That's the Irish Times Europe correspondent Naomi O'Leary.
As people wait for news on the further easing of restrictions, there was a rise in COVID cases yesterday. 617 new infections were recorded, with schools and workplaces responsible for a significant part of that increase. Some counties have a disproportionate number of new infections. Apart from Dublin, there were substantial rises in Donegal, Offaly, Kildare and Meath. There were 176 people in hospital yesterday, 48 of whom were in intensive care. Dr. Dennis McCauley is chair of the Irish Medical Organisation's GP committee, and he's on the line. Good morning and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
From what you and other GPs are seeing at the moment, what's your overall assessment of the situation?
I think the overall assessment is, as the Chief Medical Officer said yesterday, I think it is clear that there's a vaccination effect, but it's happening, more in the hospital still. I think the rates are steady in the actual community, and I've always maintained recently that this is primarily due to the good actions of the Irish people. I think that the rates have remained very steady, and I think that's to do with people doing what they're supposed to do. I think they're not coming down any lower because the variant is still the variant and it is more infectious. So I think that, unfortunately, as is usual, something odd is happening in the northwest. I think that there's an issue with the border and North Donegal, and I think that's why the rate in Derry is the same as the rate in North Donegal. But there's a problem. The rate in Derry is double the rate that is there in the rest of Northern Ireland, and it's double the rate, and the rate in Donegal is double the rate in the rest of Ireland. But one is a vaccinated population. Mm-hmm. They're vaccinating. They're over 30s now, and in Donegal we're not as vaccinated, so there is a risk there.
The vaccination rate in the south has gathered pace, we know that, but it's still not where many hoped it would be. Do you believe that the government targets can be met?
I do, yes. I think that I think the vaccination program, as your previous commentator said, is going well. We're, you know, we're along the European average. We're doing as well as we can. I think that, you know, if you compare us with Denmark, the only difference is they got extra Pfizer. So we're actually, I think we should be pleased. We are the infrastructure and the people are working hard. As soon as we get vaccine, we're actually giving it. We gave up to 500 vaccines on Thursday because we were actually happy to do that. So I think that the GPs are continuing to be a major contributor. Hopefully that will sort of end soon once we've finished vaccinating the medical vulnerable, and then the vaccination will be taken over by the regional vaccination centres then. But I think we are doing a very good job. We keep looking at the UK, but I think we are catching. I think there is going to be the issue with the Johnson & Johnson issue, but I think that has been slightly helped by the fact we've got our hands on 500,000 more vaccines.
Where do you stand then? Where do you stand then on lengthening the gap between doses of those other vaccines, the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna?
I suppose there's two things I would say. One is that I think that the medically vulnerable, I think, should be, I think ethically and from a medical context, we should continue with the one month issue there. I think that is important, but I think we have to look at the modelling. I think that, you know, we're not that far away from the amount of vaccines that we had set out to reach the target of 80% by June. So I think what we have to do is two factors really. I think the medically vulnerable should have that gap because they have been, particularly the group four, they have been acting like the people over 70. They have been avoiding the world for the last year. And I think to give them the vaccine bonus of being able to go out into the world, you know, sooner is ethically right. But I think then you have to look at the modelling to see what actual difference it would actually make. I think the last commentary that the last commentator you had hopefully will get people to have confidence in the actual vaccination programme. We're doing well, but nothing dents that confidence more than a bit of confusion and change. So I think the modelling would have to be very clear and very obvious before I would do it, because I think, you know, the AstraZeneca decision last week, I think people are beginning to sort of say, well, yeah, we are getting there. So any change has to be shown to be very obviously a good idea.
Obviously, as a GP, and you know, including your fellow GPs as well, you're dealing with more than COVID. Can I ask, have you noticed a rise in the number of people whose mental health is being affected by this? Because we've had four hard months of lockdown now.
Oh, I think undoubtedly. I think there's, everybody's talking about long COVID, but I think one of the specialties that will be experiencing this in the long term will be the actual psychiatric services. I think you have to visualise people. There's certain people who are generally anxious, and they have been, this whole time has been very stressful for them, and their actual support structures have not been there. They haven't been able to get reassurance from other people. And then there's people who just thrive on actual company and so forth. So on a very simplistic level, that is an issue. But yes, people are tired, but also they're anxious and they are depressed. And I think that it will be one of the long COVID features that we will be treating, even when the lockdown is eased somewhat. It will take a long time for the effect of the lockdown to sort of dissipate for these people. So it has been very difficult for them.
Looking at the HSE briefing yesterday, they were talking about the rise in the number of people going to emergency departments. And I note that there's a particular problem in Limerick, but then there often is in the emergency department there. Are you seeing other patients, people with other problems or concerns, returning to your office?
Yes. Remember that general practice has been essentially open. We have, I think, except for the two very bad surges that we had, one in January, February, just one in January, and similarly, there was a surge, particularly in Donegal in October. General practice has tried to remain open, and the face-to-face we have face-to-face consultations every day now. We just essentially, our phone triaging is very limited to people who have respiratory issues. So we're seeing people with the normal things again, but naturally the footfall is down still, but I think that's mainly a COVID effect. People are going out less, and so therefore they're going to their GP less for minor things. But we are encouraging everybody with anything that they're worried about to go and see their actual GP, and it will invariably involve a face-to-face consultation if they are worried.
Dr. Dennis McCauley, thanks indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland. Dennis McCauley there, who's chair of the IMO's GP committee.
And our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds joins us now with more details on that Garda seizure of more than 2,000 stolen catalytic car converters and other equipment in Dublin last night. Paul, this was a seizure worth more than €2 million. Tell us about the Garda search.
Yeah, it's the largest ever seizure of stolen catalytic car converters. Only the theft has been increasing in recent months, people will know. The Garda in Ballymun and Santry in Dublin set up the Dublin North Divisional Task Force to target the gangs involved. Now, yesterday morning, they raided a business yard in Finglas in Dublin. They found 2,150 catalytic converters and 14 drums of smelted catalytic converters, essentially melted down metal, with a combined value of €2.2 million. They were. They also had officials from Revenue and Customs, the Revenue Sniffer Dog, and officials from the National Transfrontier Shipments Office. That's a section of Dublin City Council's Waste Division. They were also involved. Now, the 14 drums each contained around 300 catalytic converters smelted into powder form. They were worth. The drums were worth around €1 million. The Garda estimate the unsmelted catalytic converters are worth around €1.2 million. The Garda also recovered €74,240 in cash. A vehicle was also seized. A man in his 20s was arrested and questioned at Ballymun. He was charged yesterday evening and he's due before the Criminal Courts of Justice, the District Court in Dublin, next month. Now, this one is the fourth such seizure in the past 2 months as part of this targeted investigation. It also includes the seizures of 110 converters, €27,500 in cash and £55,000 in sterling. That was in County Meath in February, and then just last week in St Margaret's in Dublin, another 300 catalytic converters were also discovered.
Tell me about this black market in catalytic converters. First of all, what they are and why it's growing, and obviously smelting, you mentioned, and the amounts of money to be made there.
Yeah, I mean, they're a honeycomb structure device. They're fitted to the underside of cars and they work by cleansing or cleaning the engine fumes as they pass through the exhaust. They convert the pollutant gases into less harmful ones. Now, there's been a huge increase in the theft of these converters. There's no definitive figures, but there are provisional figures to show that, for example, in 2017, there were only 79 stolen, while last year there was more than 1,300. But the Garda believe figures are much higher than this. And this seizure yesterday... illustrates that. Now, the thieves use very large car jacks to lift a car off the ground in seconds and electronic tools to cut the converters from underneath the cars. Most people will know of someone who has one stolen and had one stolen. There's often a number of cars in one street or one area targeted by a gang in one night. The gangs often drive around and do reconnaissance recces to see what type of cars, for example, older Toyota Priuses are a particular favourite. They are targeted by the gangs. People have often woken up to the gangs as they're stealing their catalytic converters, but by the time they've gotten down the stairs or out to the car, the gang's gone.
Crime correspondent Paul Reynolds, thank you.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia, movement that inspires.
And with the sport, here's Des Cahill.
Hi, Rachel. Yeah, busy morning and good times for Irish gymnastics because Rhys McLennan and Adam Steele have joined Emma Slevin in qualifying for finals at the European Gymnastics Championships in Switzerland. McLennan secured his place in the pommel horse final, qualifying in first place with a score of 14.766. That final takes place tomorrow afternoon. Adam Steele had an excellent competition all round in all six of the men's apparatus. He finished in 20th position with a score of 79.731. In doing so, he's made it to the men's all-round final, which takes place this afternoon. It'll be live on the RTE player. It follows on, of course, from the women's all-round top 24 final, which will feature Emma Slevin. That's on RTE2 from 12:15. In soccer, UEFA are to make a final decision on Euro 2020 host cities today by video conference. It's expected Dublin will lose out. There was one game in the English Premier League last night where Leicester City beat West Brom by 3-0. Jamie Vardy, Johnny Evans and Kelechi Iheanacho got the goals in a first half blitz. So while West Brom are now staring relegation in the face, Leicester remain in third place and look good for a Champions League spot. They're 4 points clear of both Chelsea and West Ham. Back home, we have two games in the Premier Division tonight. Finn Harps play St Pat's at 5:45, and then Shamrock Rovers take on Bohemians at 7:45 in the live RTE game. It's the side's third game in 8 days. Rovers are boosted by Tuesday's late win at Drogheda, but after their home defeat to Sligo on the same night, Bows manager Keith Long was asked if he'd be making changes for tonight's game.
Well, we'll see. Friday will tell its own story. So we've brought in some different players tonight. So we've changed things up a little bit, as we've always done, you know, particularly on, when you've got three games in 8 days. So I think it's important that you use your squad. We have a squad here for a reason. They're not just here to sit in the stand and to watch others play. And there was an opportunity tonight for people to come in and do well. And I think we did see some good displays, but ultimately we've lost the game. And I suppose that's all that matters.
Now, there are also four games in the First Division tonight and one in England where Arsenal meet Everton. Meanwhile, Waterford issued a statement last night to confirm that Kevin Sheedy and Mike Newell remain in charge after speculation yesterday they had left the club. Derry City are expected to name their new manager this morning after parting with Declan Devine. There's strong speculation that Rory Higgins is set to be offered the job. He's currently part of Stephen Kenny's backroom team with the Irish national squad, where he's chief scout and opposition analyst. In golf, Leona Maguire and Stephanie Meadow both failed to make the cut at the LA Open. Maguire shot 76 to finish on 3 over. That's one shot outside the cut. Meadow was 7 over. Jessica Korda leads on 13 under. Graham McDowell and Matt Wallace shot an opening round of 6 under par 66 at the Zurich Classic. It's an unusual pairs event. The leaders are on 10 under. Now rugby, and Ulster take on Connacht tonight in the Rainbow Cup. It's Leinster against Munster tomorrow. We're going to look ahead to those games in a moment with our commentator Michael Corcoran. But first, Michael, tomorrow's game in the Women's Six Nations. Ireland play Italy at midday, and Ireland have to pick themselves up after that heavy defeat to France last weekend.
Yes, they do. Good morning, Des. It's a huge game, actually, really, for the Ireland women's team. Both sides coming into the match in sort of contrasting humour in terms of confidence, because Italy, with that big 41-20 win over Scotland in Scotland last week, Ireland on the back end of a really heavy defeat by France, and it'll be interesting to see how they react in terms of the sort of reaction from that defeat when they take on Italy. A number of changes made to the starting team. I suppose one player who isn't there is Claire Malloy, which is kind of unusual. She's been a mainstay in the back row for Ireland when she's been fit. But I feel that the replacements who came on last week made a huge difference. And it'll be interesting to see how Stacey Flood, Brittany Hogan and Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe get on their first starts for Ireland. I thought Stacey Flood did really well at out half. And it's a massively important game, because there's been a lot of noise from outside the camp, you know, directed at Adam Griggs and the RFU, and the players get their chance to put something right in terms of putting in a good performance against the Italians tomorrow.
And do you expect them to win it?
I think Ireland are probably better. Now, having said that, the Italian team kind of scare me, to be fair about it. Manuela Forlan, their captain on the wing, you know, got 3 tries last week, and Ireland were naive defensively out wide, and that was exposed against the French. But I think if Ireland are a bit smarter and play better, I think Ireland could just about do it.
Okay, now the Rainbow Cup begins this weekend. It's become a bit of a mess because the South African sides couldn't get here. And I know this is tough times, very tough times financially for the IRFU, but we have Ulster Connacht tonight and Leinster Munster tomorrow. But the provinces are meeting so often now, Michael. Is there a danger of causing fans' interest to wane?
I would say there probably is. It would be interesting, actually, Des, if fans or, you know, people who would go to the matches, how many would actually turn up. I mean, if you look at tomorrow's game initially in terms of the fixture, Leinster Munster will meet tomorrow for the fifth time since the 22nd of August last year. Now, in fairness to both of the teams, you know, two of those matches, in fact, were outside the regular season. One was a semi-final, the other was a final. But yeah, I mean, the difficulty for the RFU and the organisers of the competition, obviously, is that they thought that the South African teams are going to be coming back into this one, and that's why the regular Pro 14 season was curtailed, basically, to try and bring in a cup element to it ahead of the British and Irish Lions Tour in a couple of months' time. So it's just unfortunate from that point of view that that the South African teams are not in it. But, you know, it is what it is, and sort of familiar foes face each other in Belfast tonight and indeed in the RDS tomorrow.
All right, and we look forward to those. And Michael will bring us commentary on both of those games, Ulster Connacht tonight, Leinster Munster tomorrow night. In swimming, Danielle Hill and Finn McGeever enjoyed another fine evening at the Irish National Swimming Team Trials. Hill broke her third record of the meet, the 100 freestyle, in an impressive 55.33 seconds. And Limerick's Finn McGeever broke his first Irish senior record in the 400 freestyle, a time of 3 minutes 52.83. The Irish senior men's and women's basketball teams can resume training today after COVID as they prepare for the European Championships, and we have two race meetings. Cork begins at 1:20 and Kilbeggan at 4:25.
We're going to talk about India now, which is grappling with a huge surge in COVID-19 infections. India is now reporting the highest daily rates of any country in the world since the pandemic began. More than 315,000 new infections yesterday, thousands dying daily, and hospitals running out of beds and oxygen. Mandakini Gaylo is Channel 4 News correspondent in India. And Mandakini, we've seen truly horrific TV pictures and the reports coming out of India. Describe to our listeners just how bad the situation is this morning.
Thank you, Anya, for inviting me. Our cities are under siege. I've never witnessed anything like this. At the heart of the problem is that our healthcare system has collapsed, just absolutely shattered. As you said, there are just, you know, for love of God or money, it's impossible to get a hospital bed right now if you are in one of the larger metro cities. There are no beds, there's no oxygen, there are no ventilators, and each morning just brings with it a string of bad news of the kind that we've never seen. Now, according to the WHO's own estimate, one out of every three patients in the world suffering from coronavirus are in India, and our healthcare system is just not able to handle it. One of the largest hospitals in New Delhi, the Sir Gangaram Hospital, usually a very good hospital, lost 25 patients last night because they had to lower the level at which they were giving these patients oxygen because they had only about 2 hours of supplies left. In Mumbai, as you've no doubt seen, there was a fire at a hospital which just made things so much worse. I mean, it's really hard for me to describe what's going on. It's extraordinary. We have private hospitals approaching the judicial system, the courts, appealing that oxygen be delivered to them. They're doing that because the government is missing in action. Appeals to the government are not resulting in oxygen getting to places in time. And meanwhile, everyone's losing friends and colleagues and loved ones, and a lot of those deaths are very, very young people. So a really terrible tragedy unfolding here in India, and absolutely no doubt in my mind that the way this pandemic will come to be defined by what happens in India over the next few days and weeks.
And how, Mandakini, did it go so wrong? India is one of the world leaders in vaccines.
Absolutely. Well, a part of it is complacency. By January, India had one of the lowest infection rates anywhere in the world, and the government chose to declare victory rather triumphantly. And of course, everything went back to normal very quickly. Now, experts all agree it shouldn't have happened like that. Not only did offices and, schools, etc., start reopening, but we also started handing out permissions for huge, massive religious gatherings. We started doing election rallies. In fact, even now, the Home Minister of India, Mr. Amit Shah, conducted a public rally yesterday in West Bengal.
So the government sort of shifted its focus towards electioneering and campaigning. And some of these large, massive events like the Kumbh Mela, which is a Hindu religious gathering that began at the beginning of April, and by the way, has not yet been cancelled. Some of these events triggered a second wave. Now, the vaccine question, I imagine a lot of heads are going to roll in the coming weeks and months, because honestly, like you said, the world's largest producer, and you cannot get a vaccine here. You just cannot. My mother, for example, has had her first shot, and we're not sure she'll get the second one. Now, why is that happening? The government, to start with, didn't place enough orders. They only ordered something like 100 million vaccines from the Serum Institute of India and allowed the rest to be exported, which, you know, India has to play that role. India has to export. But they just didn't accumulate enough for our own people. Mm-hmm. Now the Prime Minister has announced that vaccinations will open to everyone above the age of 18 by May 1st. Right now, it's only people above 45. But we know that even those who qualify right now are not able to get one. So it's rather wishful that they will, you know, magically everyone will get a vaccine on May 1st.
And finally, Mandakini, the question, is there a new variant that's driving this surge in India, or is it those super spreading events you've described?
I would have to say, based on my conversations with epidemiologists and experts, that it's a combination of the both. There is a uniquely Indian strain, the B1617, now prevalent in many countries, including the UK. Unfortunately, scientists don't know enough about it yet. We don't know its transmissibility, its lethality, whether vaccines work with it. But it is a strain that's spreading very quickly. But again, it's so difficult to get accurate data here. Even the mortality rate that you're seeing is so underrepresented that it's just hard to say whether it's the strain or whether it's the super spreader events. It's just a combination of those things combined with government complacency and combined with the complacency at the level of the citizens who started to, you know, take the masks off and go back to normal. So I'd say it's a bunch of factors that's contributing to this wave.
Well, thank you for describing it so eloquently to us this morning. Mandakini Gallo, Channel 4 news correspondent in India.